For a rainy day, you can sure get thirsty. All right. Well, we have, as was mentioned in the announcements and sermonette as well, Feast of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement coming up soon. Prelude to the Feast of Tabernacles in both instances. This is a festival-rich time of the year that God has organized. And sometimes you wonder why he stacks them up as he did and why he didn't spread the holy days out more through the year, but I figure God knows why he did it. And he knows the impact, the best impact that it would have on our lives. And certainly the Feast of Tabernacles is a grand time, and the two holy days that lead to it. It's also a time for trials. You know, we have our pre-feast trials. Sometimes there are post-feast trials, but they seem to be more pre-feast trials. And I don't know if you've noticed it over the years, but it certainly has been the case. As we ramp up to the holy days, international tensions increase in the world. Airplanes have a habit of falling out of the sky. We're not surprised. Satan is called the prince of the power of the air in Ephesians chapter 2. But we are certainly seeing the heating up of the world situation and heating up toward war. This is the news. Just even the past several days have been more like the really sensitive times during the Cold War era than we've had in a long time. Just reflecting on that a little bit, because I think the concept of wars and battles fits in with what I have in mind to go over today. And it's a topic that has a kind of a bridge connection between the trumpets and atonement as well. But we, if you've been monitoring the news, you're aware of ISIS's most recent claim that the refugee migration into Europe and the United States is not all just refugees. They say we are going to use that to infiltrate the West with more terrorists. And the evidence seems to back them up. Of course, they're, you know, part of the political crowd in our country and others are trying to ignore that, pretend that it doesn't exist, just like Great Britain tried to pretend that Adolf Hitler didn't exist or was actually a very likable chap if you just got to know him. And then they got to know him and he wasn't so likable. But that's what ISIS is saying, and very openly, too. You know, they're not trying to hide that. And when you look at the statistics on some of the refugees moving into Europe right now, an awful high percentage of them are very able-bodied young men. The classic ISIS soldier age group. They haven't been in the news just this week, but recently they have, of course. The Boko Haram Islamic group in Nigeria, they control about a third, between a third and a half of the country of Nigeria, the northern section. And they continue to create international tensions there. But the Middle East seems to be the hottest point. There was an offensive launched against the Houthi down in Yemen with the assistance of, I think, some troops from Qatar or Bahrain, as well as some support from Saudi Arabia. This is an extension, apparently, of the Islamic State group. We also have the rhetoric coming out of Iran. And it's gotten hotter and more arrogant in its tone because they have the upper hand. They have the United States, which apparently we promised to attack anybody who attacks them, which, you know, puts the state of Israel in a pretty tough spot. And you think, how in the world did that happen? But then again, you stop and think, look at our political landscape and how in the world did it not happen until now? Russia has been starting to flex its military muscles increasingly, too, in spite of the fact that they're having their economic difficulties. And they, just this past week, have been beginning to send in more shipments of arms and apparently troops into Syria. I presume that they're backing President Assad. you know, his faction in the Syrian civil war. But that puts Syria, it puts Russia there. Iran is massing some troops on the border with the Syrian border with Israel. There was a report about that that came out this week. And then China, you know, I think, well, China's, you know, out of business because of the economic situation, and they are in economic straits, just like Russia is. But then who's not in economic straits, including this one, in this country? But China is not in bad enough shape that they can't send their newly floated navy into the territorial waters of the United States up in Alaska, which is flexing military muscle. That's taunting the United States by sailing their warships unbidden into our territorial waters. America was once a superpower. Not so much anymore. When you look at these tensions and then we read the prophecies, we know that, you know, war is in the making in the future. Maybe the not too distant future. Certainly the dynamics, the immorality makes us begin to see how tenuous the hold of this society is on any kind of stability at all. So we have much to pray about for God's will to be done and for his direction in all of these events. And again, it seems, this is true to form, we have the intensity of these things increasing as we approach a holy day season, whether autumn or spring, but especially, it seems, in the autumn. Thus, I think it might be an interesting sermon and an important one for us to consider the concept of battles. But in this case, the battles of the devil and the Messiah. The battles of the devil and the Messiah. All the wars, all the battles of this world root right back to the devil's influence among mankind. But he has had his confrontations directly with Christ. And as we anticipate Christ's second coming, and that time the neutralizing of Satan's power, we'll read that passage. I think it's important that we realize the dynamics that have existed throughout eternity, well, throughout history, at least since Satan chose to be Satan and no longer to be the light bringer or Lucifer. Let's start with what happened in the Garden of Eden. Go to Genesis chapter 1, and then chapter 3 after that. But I want us to draw our attention to the first couple of verses in the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then, verse 2 says, the earth was without form and void, and the Hebrew words there are tohu and bohu, which are also rendered chaos and confusion. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. So there was it appears, a worldwide flood at that time. God does not create anything in confusion. You can find that in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. I believe it's verse 33, but you can find it there. God is not the author of confusion. Therefore, when God created the earth, it was created in order. And then something happened. This is how we've always read that passage. Something happened. We know what happened. It was Satan's rebellion. He struck down what Christ had begun to make and, you know, went through wrecking it. And a lot of our fossil record is probably evidence of that very thing. Then God came back and reordered the earth, didn't recreate it particularly, but reordered it so that it could be a habitation for mankind. And he proceeded to, in verse 26, let us make man in our image, God said, according to our likeness. So we look like God looks. And God does look. You know, it's a strange thing. The Greeks had a concept of spirit, but it had no form, no shape. It was like a fog, they said. And traditional Christianity, when you get into their theology, that's how they view spirit. But that's wrong. Spirit has form. God wants it to have form. God is the one who makes things and gives them their forms. And certainly the physical universe has form because God made it that way, and therefore we look like God looks. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the cattle, over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. This fact alone disproves the argument of the, I don't know what to call them, animal lovers. I've forgotten what, animal rights activists, that's what it is. They have a saying. A dog is a pig is a boy. The lives are equal in value. I think that was Cleveland Amory, one of their key thinkers. The humans have no more value than any other life form. They still swat mosquitoes, however. So I think that they're a little bit hypocritical. This verse shows that their idea is completely non-biblical. It's not what God thinks. Human life is the highest life form on the planet. It is the only life form that has divine potential. None of the other animals do. We have pets, and we like our pets, but our pets are not going to have eternal life. Some people want to know, well, can I recreate my pet in the millennium? You know, so that I can have so an old Rover back. Well, I don't know, maybe. But why? You know, you never know what the next pet's going to be like. You know, they're always an adventure. Whatever the case, human life is created in God's image. Dogs aren't created in God's image. Monkeys aren't created in God's image, not even the big monkeys. And no matter how hard the evolutionary anthropologists try to use their imagination to think so, and to make them look like humans, they found something down in a cave in South Africa this past week, and they're just sure it's another human ancestor going way back when. But that's not how God made things. God made things the way he made them, and mankind doesn't know. And the reason he doesn't know is because one of the battles the devil has, an ongoing battle of deceiving mankind. Now, let's go back to this initial battle that man got wrapped up in chapter 3. Now, the serpent, verse 1 of chapter 3, the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And I'd love to understand that a little bit better. And this is a general commentary about serpents, but obviously this serpent was definitely more cunning. Snakes, I think, have the appearance of being cunning. Maybe it's because they move slowly, except when they strike. I don't know if you enjoy watching snakes, but we watched out for snakes all the time. I don't know that how their intelligence is rated. They rate the intelligence of animals. Pigs rank very high. They're not like chimpanzees, but they're around the intelligence of a dog, and a horse comes right after them. I don't know why they didn't have the Porky Express riders of the West, but instead of Pony Express riders. But the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field that the Lord God had made, and he said to the woman, obviously God didn't create snakes with the ability to talk, so now we realize this form was taken on by the devil for a particular reason. He said to the woman, has God indeed said you shall not eat of every tree in the garden? And Eve wasn't on her guard because that snake shouldn't have talked. Adam named all the animals. Now, granted, that was before he had to take a nap, so she wasn't there. She came during the nap. But Adam didn't comment on anything talking back to him except in whatever bark, meow, whinny, or moo that they had, or squeal, or whatever. None of them commented in human language about the names that he gave them. But here, the snake was talking. And the woman said to the serpent, We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden. Okay, she had remembered that God had said that. But of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. So she knew that one tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that you read about over in verses 8 to 9, and then later again in verse 15 and 16 of, or through 17 of chapter 2, there was the tree of life and there was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And we can eat of the tree of life, was included in all the other trees, but the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was the one tree they couldn't eat from. And so she recognized that. And then Satan continued. This is a classic study in the con of getting around, you know, the dishonorable sales technique that sometimes gets used. Then the serpent said to the woman, oh, you won't really die. You won't surely die. For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. And you think, what is he basing that on? We think it because we're after the fact and we've got the textbook. But she was, you know, Eve on the spot with no textbook yet, other than the very specific directions which she just quoted back to him. And all he had to do was to confidently countermand that the statement of fact that God had given, and she crumbled. She saw that the tree was good for food. And how do you see that a tree is good for food unless you have a guidebook? You know, Peterson's Guide to Trees in the Garden of Eden. Eat and don't eat. There's one don't eat and the others are eat. She didn't have that, so how could she look at the tree and say it was good for food? There's an obvious bafflement here. Eve was gullible, and you think, yeah, women are all gullible. Well, they're not all gullible. And there was another problem that wasn't Eve. We'll talk about him in a moment. So she saw the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes. Now you can deduce that it is pleasant to the eyes by looking at it. You can tell that. Most trees are pleasant to the eyes, and some are more than others. A tree desirable to make one wise. Not if God forbids it. So now what we're seeing here is Eve's reasoning. Desirable to make one wise. So she took of its fruit and she ate. And gave to her husband with her, and he ate. But in 1 Timothy chapter 2, in verse 14, it said, Adam was not deceived. Eve was in the transgression, but Adam was not deceived. Adam was not deceived, and he ate it anyway. He saw through the argument, and he went ahead and ate of the fruit of the tree that they weren't even supposed to eat at all. So you see, Adam didn't do what was his duty to do, which was to say, uh-uh, God said, we don't have anything to do with that tree. And then, of course, the fact was they realized that they were naked. Not that that made any difference. They were the only two human beings on the earth. The whole world was their bedroom at the time. But Satan creates senses of shame and impropriety in all aspects that lead to sin. And so here we have a battle. This was the battle in the Garden of Eden. Why it was a battle is because in chapter 2, God had given them specific directions about how to live in the Garden of Eden. And in chapter 3, the first thing they did is cave in to the challenge, and they ate of the tree they weren't supposed to. They could have eaten of all the other trees, but no, they ate the wrong fruit from the wrong tree. It was a battle. The humans were the ones that were caught in the middle of it. It was a battle of God teaching versus the devil teaching. And they succumbed to the devil. Now, there's a follow-up to this right here in chapter 3. That will then lead us on to some of the other battles of the devil and the Messiah. In verse 15, God is talking to the serpent. And me by the serpent, he of course means, as we know, the devil. That's where the sentience is in the devil taking on the form of the serpent or possessing the serpent or whatever he did. Because you have done this, he said, you are cursed more than all cattle and more than all the beasts of the field. On your belly you shall go and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. So the snake was cursed. Now, we don't know. Maybe the snakes had legs before that, and then after that, God changed them genetically so they wouldn't have legs. Bear in mind, God can just do that if he wants to change a life form into its shape, because he's the one that made it in the first place. And then verse 15, and I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. We don't have all that many affectionate herpetologists in the world, people who study snakes. We don't have that many herpetologists at all. But there aren't that many people that really, really like snakes. Normally, the snake is a scary thing for people, which is the whole idea of those little plastic ones that they have in the stores, like at the restaurants that have a little gift shop off to the side so that little brother can scare his sisters with them. So God would put enmity between mankind and the snake. And then we get to the last part. Between your seed, those who are influenced by the devil, and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Now, that last part is a prophecy. That Satan would bruise the heel of Christ. In other words, he would precipitate the death of Christ when he came to earth as a human being. But Christ, the Messiah, would bruise his head. Bear in mind, the word Christ comes from the Greek word Christos, just Christ with an O-S on the end. And that is the Greek translation of the Hebrew word Messiah. The two words therefore mean exactly the same thing. And Messiah itself, translated, means the anointed one or the Lord's anointed, whoever God has picked. And obviously, Christ is the ultimate Lord's anointed. It was also a title that was given to the kings of Israel up until the civil war after Solomon's death. So David and Solomon were messiahs in a general sense, not like Christ is, but they were types of Christ in that sense. So the battle of the Garden of Eden and the seed, that is Christ, would bruise the head of the devil. Now let's look at this concept of seed because this helps us understand the other battles that we'll look at here. Let's go next to Numbers chapter 24. Numbers 24. This is the setting here in Numbers 24. It's a very interesting one. Israel is coming up out of the Sinai. They are making their trek up to the Promised Land. And they're going through some Midianite territory at the time. So the king of the Midianites finds this so-called prophet named Balaam, or Balaam, as it might be said. When you get a double A's, we say Balaam. It would be pronounced a little differently, but we'll use Balaam. Balaam was the false prophet. However, God let him prophesy about Israel, but he couldn't curse them. He was supposed to get up on a hill above the Israelites and pronounce curses on them, which is, you know, the way of many of the religions of this world, of various ones, and they're appealing, frankly, to the power of Satan. They don't know that necessarily. God intervened. Only thing that could come out of Balaam's mouth was blessings. So we'll pick up those blessings in verse 5. How lovely are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel, like valleys that stretch out, like gardens by the riverside, like aloes planted by the Lord, like cedar trees beside the waters. Beautiful description. He shall pour water from his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters. His seed in many waters. The descendants. Seed means descendants. You know, a plant produces seeds, and then those seeds produce plants that produce seeds, and so on. So there are descendants. If you hold your place there in Numbers, but look back briefly in Revelation chapter 15, let's understand the symbolism of the term waters in a prophecy. Sometimes it's just talking about water itself, but other times waters has a prophetic meaning. This is one of those times. This is a prophecy in Revelation 17 about the great harlot, Mystery Babylon the Great, mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth, up in verse 5, who sits on many waters. And then he said to me in verse 15 is the key point here. Then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. So we have, going back then to Numbers, and his seed shall be in many waters. Ultimately, his seed, with the concept of the capital S, that is Christ, the Messiah, would be in many people. That God's seed would be Christ's seed, his influence, his teaching, ultimately God's Spirit would be in many people. So the seed of Genesis carried over to here, and we have one other place that we want to go for that as well. It's in Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah chapter 6. Now, this is a chapter where Isaiah is getting his marching orders. He actually volunteered. God said, I need somebody to do this and such, and Isaiah volunteered. In vision, he volunteered, and so he got the job. And also, this is a area where it also talks about his wife. The wife of Isaiah was a prophet. His wife was called a prophetess. And they had two sons. They may have had more, but they had certainly two. One's name was Shir Yashub. Shir Yashub means a remnant returns. And the concept of a remnant of Israel surviving is one of the main themes of the entire book of Isaiah. So Shir Yashub was a prophecy. His name was a prophecy. The remnant returns. Now we know, looking back, that already the house of Israel had been taken captive. After Isaiah was only a prophet for a few years, the captivity of Israel took place. Then he prophetically was pointing out that the Jews would be taken captive too, which would be about 100 years after Isaiah. And then they were, of course. But a remnant would survive. A remnant would return. And it's that remnant that we're talking about. Now we come down to Isaiah chapter 6, verse 13. But the tenth will be in it. Verse 12, let's start with verse 12, verse 11. I said, O Lord, how long? And he answered, until the cities are laid waste without inhabitant, the houses without a man, the land is utterly desolate. The Lord has removed men far away. Indeed, they were taken into Assyria, and then the Jews would be taken to Babylon later. And the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land, but yet, verse 13, first line, but yet a tenth will be in it, a tenth, which is a tiny fraction of the amount of the original amount, a remnant. And will return and be for consuming. So there would be a return of the Jews. And it was only a remnant of the Jews that returned to Israel at all, and the ten tribes didn't come. They never thoroughly returned and resettled in the Promised Land. They went a-wandering. The great Volkwanderung, except it, we would date the Volkwanderung, the people wandering, it's a historical term. It's normally thought of to be between 300 and 600. It's the Goths and the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths and the other Goths and none of the Emos and the Alani and all the other elements of the tribes of Israel sweeping into Europe and wandering back and forth and finally settling someplace. The Visigoths, for instance, came charging down through the center of Europe, marauded their way amongst the Gauls, who were distant relatives of theirs, down through France, crossed into Spain, swept through there, conquering anything. They vanquished one of the Roman armies in the meantime. And then they crossed the Mediterranean Sea, at the narrow part of it, and they took over Carthage. That had been the Phoenician the essentially New Phoenicia there. Carthage replaced Tyre and Sidon as the center of the Phoenicians. Well, what was left of it, they just took it over, and they had an empire there in North Africa for 80 years. That was the grain bin of Romans. And so they held they had a chokehold on the Romans' food supply. And then history says they just disappeared. The Visigoths got in boats. They weren't sailors. They weren't Vikings, but they knew how to build boats for some reason. And they sailed away. And they sailed west and northwest. They went back up into northern Europe, evidently. But it was one of those tribe-tracking issues that were going on. That period of time was called the Völkerwanderung, the people wandering in German. German historian coined the term. But it actually began much earlier when you think about the very ancestors of those people began their wanderings. And Isaiah is alluding to that. A fraction of them would return and be for the consuming. And then we go down to the end of this verse 13. As a terebinth tree or as an oak whose stump remains when it is cut down. So they're going to be like trees that get cut down, but the stump will remain. The remnant of the tree is still there. So the holy seed shall be its stump. In other words, out of the remnant of the Jews, because by this time it was the Jews that were left, out of the remnant of the Jews would come the holy seed, Christ. Christ himself. Those who returned, that remnant who returned would then be there by the time of Christ, and part of it would be the line of David, and we have the genealogy of Christ through Mary, and another one through Joseph, and they both go back to King David, legally, through his stepfather Joseph, and the bloodline of Mary all goes back to David. And so the holy seed, and the term seed here is a reference to Christ in that sense, shall be in its stump. So we have the seed understood. Now let's look at one more prophecy here in Isaiah. It's in chapter 7 and verse 14. Chapter 7, verse 14. Behold, a virgin will conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel, which I believe means God in us. Curds and honey shall he eat, and he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. He will know to choose good and reject evil. So the holy seed would choose good, not evil. And that would be Christ, of course. And then it goes on because the prophecy is tied up in the two sons of Isaiah and his wife. Shir Yashub was... hard enough to spell, but the younger son, who was born here, it goes on to say this, Before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that you dread will be forsaken by both her kings. So it was a prophecy that was timed for Isaiah's day, but that was for their younger son as he was just coming out of infancy into toddler. His name was Maher Shalal Hashbaz. You imagine having that as a handle and going into kindergarten and having to write it in Hebrew? Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Hasten the spoil. Seize the booty. You know, get the loot. Talking about, you know, even Judah being overrun and the enemy coming in and taking the spoils, you know, grabbing whatever was valuable when they leave. So we have then the identity of the holy seed and that the true Messiah would choose good and reject evil, the very thing that Adam and Eve didn't do. Now, in the choosing of good, we're going to go to another battle that is actually set in the New Testament era. It's in Matthew 4 and Luke 4. We'll look at the Matthew version, and then we'll touch on one verse out of the version in Luke. Same event. This is the temptation of Christ. The temptation of Christ by the devil was a spiritual battle. Now, this wasn't a battle where you're hurling planets and galaxies at each other. This was a battle that was far, far deeper than something like that. chapter 4 of Matthew. I went to Luke when I said to go to Matthew. Okay, here we are. Now, Christ has just been baptized by John the Baptist. He came immediately up out of the water in verse 16 of chapter 3. And the Spirit saw the Spirit of God descending on him like a dove, actually alighting upon him. And a voice came from heaven saying, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." So that ends chapter 3. Then Jesus was led, and immediately afterwards, led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. So he went to an uninhabited area to be tempted by Satan. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterward he was hungry. I think by sundown on Atonement, we'll all be hungry. And that'll be one night and one day, not 40 days and 40 nights. But he was hungry, which shows that as a human being, he felt the pangs that human beings feel. He was hungry. Now, when the tempter came to him, that's the devil, is the tempter, he said, "If you are the Son of God, if, you know, you are who you say you are, then command that these stones become bread." And he didn't mean that white, doughy, tasteless bread. Pardon me, I think white bread pretty tasteless. It's what you put on it is where you get your flavor. I like bread that stands up and talks to you while you're consuming it, you know. Carries on a conversation with the various grains and all the different flours that have such far marvelous flavors. But whatever the case, I think it was more like that bread, you know, the whole grain style bread. And so Satan is tempting him. He probably elaborated on how good it would smell. Now, have you ever smelled really good, freshly baked bread? My grandmother would bake bread, and as we came into the church, she wasn't called until a few years later, but we began to learn about whole grain breads, and the white flour was used less and less, and whole grain flour replaced it. And so she began to change. She never changed completely to totally whole wheat bread, but it was at least half and half, and then she would dump in a whole lot of extra wheat germ, which upped the nutritional ante quite significantly and improved the flavor too. And we were 80 yards from her house and our house on the farm, and we get off the school bus. If the wind was right, you'd take one breath and you knew that you weren't going to our house. We're going to Grandma's house first. So we'd go to her house, and she had bread just coming out of the oven, and my brother and I were given a loaf. These weren't little dinky loaves. These were, you know, I'm thinking a pound and a half to 2 pound loaf. So I ate the heels. I love crust. And he didn't. And I reinforced the fact that, you know, you don't like the crust. That's the part you like. And so he grew up believing that. Still does, as far as I know. And he's only 2 years younger, or 3 years younger than me. I got the crust, but they weren't your thin, wimpy crust. I took off a half the loaf, you know, and the end off the ends, and he got the middle. And we would spread butter that we had churned under Grandma's supervision on it. And, oh, that was really fine eating. We'd eat that loaf of bread, and then we'd go do chores. We weren't allowed to touch the cinnamon rolls. They were for dessert at dinner that night. So we're talking about marvelous bread. That's what Satan would tempt him with. And Christ's response, he could have created bread. He had the power to do that. But that was not what God wanted him to be doing. Living a cushy life of creating soft stones to sit on, of creating fine bread to eat, of creating power saws out of stone and rock and steel. You know, he wasn't called to do that. He was called to live the life of a human being. And Christ knew that. And he was not going to be pulled off mission. He said, "It is written, man shall not live by bread alone." Bread isn't the reason I'm here. It isn't the reason where I was, the reason I was at my grandma's house. But it isn't the reason that we exist. Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. So he used God's word. That's Deuteronomy, I think it's chapter 8 and verse 3. He quoted it. And the devil then wasn't too surprised, it appears. So he took him up to the holy city, transported him there. He had a certain ability, and he put him on the pinnacle of the temple, which would be the southeast corner of the Temple Mount. Not on the temple itself, but on the battlements around the temple, because that's the farthest drop down into the valley Kidron. Hundreds of feet. And so he said, put him on there, and he said to him, if you are the Son of God, then throw yourself down, for it is written. Now he quotes scripture. He shall give his angels charge over you, and in their hands they will bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. Prove who you are. Now Christ was not taken off mission here either. He was not on earth to be a supernatural show-off or fool. He was there to live a life of righteousness and die as a sacrifice for the sins of the rest of mankind so that they could come to have righteousness in due course. And so Christ answered back. He said, it is written again, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. This is a battle taking place. I mean, the energy between these two beings, one is infinitely greater than the other one, but you probably couldn't convince the devil of that necessarily, that Christ was infinitely greater than him. But this was a battle that is beyond the energy levels, I would say, of any battle that humans have ever fought, no matter how big the weapons were. So again, he wasn't done. He's going to try it a third time. He took him to an exceedingly high mountain. And he showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. In Luke, on that particular section, it says, in a moment of time, he showed all the kingdoms and their glory. So it was like a vision in that sense of seeing all that they could be, maybe projecting forward technologies that they might have, and the masses of humanity, how exactly what he was displaying or giving Christ to see is hard to say. But he showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these things I will give you if you will fall down and worship me. Now we're going to find out that Satan is the ruler of this age. He had been given some authority over the earth, not over God's authority, but he had been given it. And ostensibly, he could turn that over. This is where he was offering Christ the chance to do what every beauty pageant girl wants for the world. World peace. I don't know if you've ever watched the Sandra Bullock comedy called Miss Congeniality. She's a tough FBI agent who has to masquerade as a beauty contestant in this Miss America, but it's a knockoff, this big beauty contest. And so all the beauty contestants, in all the beauty contests, as far as I know, they ask him a question. There's the interview phase. And so they're, in the movie, they're mocking it a little bit because the answer to every question is world peace. So when the Sandra Bullock character comes up for her question to be asked, what is it that you truly want for all mankind? She wants, I want harsher penalties for parole violators. Oh, and everybody goes dead silent in the audience. Oh, and world peace. And then they cheer, World peace is what Christ was offered. You see, had he taken that, in that sense, he could have made sure that the world had peace and there were no more wars. Of course, there would be no eternal life because there would be no sacrifice for the sins of mankind. But he could have had world peace and nobody would have lived longer than the Sadducees. See, the Sadducees believed, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the two political religious parties of the time. The Sadducees didn't believe in anything that wasn't in the five books of Moses. They didn't read about a resurrection there, so therefore they didn't believe there was a resurrection. And therefore they didn't believe there was any afterlife at all, that when you died you were dead and that was it. You come, you're gone. It is a miserable existence. It's almost like evolution. But that was what they thought. So that was what would happen had Christ taken that, but Christ wasn't going to take that. and the battle was won. He says, "Away with you, Satan," and he casts him away. "For it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." And the devil left him, and behold, all the angels came and ministered to him. Now, Luke adds something to where the devil left him. Switch over now to Luke chapter 4, just to note one small difference here. Not difference, it's an added bit. You have to put them together to get the full picture. In verse 13 of Luke 4, it says, "Now when the devil had ended every temptation, he departed from him until an opportune time." He lost that battle, but he would fight again. And then Jesus, verse 14 of Luke 4, returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee. He went back home. He went back to Nazareth. The news of him went throughout the surrounding region, and he taught in their synagogues and being glorified by all. So he was teaching as he was going up from the Jordan River area where he had been baptized. And he came to Nazareth, that was his hometown, where he had been brought up, as was custom was. He went into the synagogue on the Sabbath. Christ kept the Sabbath. And he stood up to read. He was a respected young man in the community, the son of Joseph, the carpenter. And he stood up to read, and he was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he opened the book, he found the place where it was written. Now, if you wanted to find this place where it was written, you would take your pages and spin them back over to Isaiah 61. But in those days, it was a scroll. So you rolled the scroll until you found it. And bear in mind that if this was a Hebrew Bible, and presumably it was, there weren't any chapter headings. You would have known it was Isaiah. You had that much. There weren't any chapter headings. There weren't any paragraphs. Everything was one paragraph, the whole thing. There were, in the Hebrew, written Hebrew language, there were no punctuation. There was no punctuation, so no periods at the end of sentences and that sort of thing. Everything runs together, but you can usually figure that out. Then you find out there weren't even any spaces between the words, so the letters were all stacked up together, but you still, well, I just look for the vowels. I can figure the word out. Oh, good. There weren't any vowels. Now, vowels were handed down by oral tradition. They weren't written down. It's a 22-consonant alphabet. So when you're skimming that, you know, your mind has to be on, you know, high alert. And he skimmed it until he came to the place that he wanted to read. And this is what he read. Verse 18. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me." He had just come off the battle with Satan. "Because he has anointed me." You know, that means that he has made him Messiah, the anointed one. "To preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to," and when you say, well, to the poor, what about the rich? Don't they need the gospel too? Oh yeah, we're talking, they're poor too though. Spiritually, physically rich maybe, but spiritually poor. Just like the people who were physically poor, they're also spiritually poor. "And he has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to encourage people who aren't encouraged, to proclaim liberty to the captives and the recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, and to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." This was a prophecy speaking about the Jubilee year. Every 50th year was a Jubilee year. God had a certain rhythm to his calendar. You know, we had the months of the calendar, but then the years had rhythms. There was a third tithe year, and the third year, and the sixth year of a seven-year cycle. And then there were the 7 years. Every 7 years was a land Sabbath, and you didn't grow crops on those days. You could eat what grew up by itself. Eat it in season, but you didn't put it up. But there was no restriction on grazing, so you meant you had more protein in your agricultural production system. And a lot of other things. It was a land rest program that ensured the ongoing fertility of the soil. And then you had seven land Sabbaths stacked up. That's 49 years. And then the 50th year was another land Sabbath. But that was the Jubilee year. On the land Sabbath year is also called the year of release in Deuteronomy 15. And that was when certain kinds of debts were forgiven. And the principle of forgiving debt, then, is where our bankruptcy laws were modeled after that concept. And so it was a fresh start for people, even after every 7 years. But at the end of every 50 years, the land itself, if somebody had gotten poor and they had to sell the farm, so to speak, and go work for somebody else as an indentured servant, number one, they were freed from their indenturedhood, and number two, they got their farm back. The land came back. You could not sell the farmland in Israel in perpetuity. You sold it in a long-term lease until the next Jubilee. That's how that worked. So this is the announcement of a Jubilee year. It's interesting. A Jubilee is the beginning of one of God's years. The years start at different times. We have, of course, in the spring, we have the first month when we have Passover and unleavened bread. The month of Aviv, also known as, Nisan, is the other name for it. But in the seventh month, when we have the Feast of Trumpets and then Atonement and Tabernacles, the Jews have their civil new year with Rosh Hashanah. That's the Feast of Trumpets. That's not the agricultural new year, though. The agricultural new year, ironically and interestingly, begins on Atonement. So the sounding of trumpets on Atonement was, in some ways, in the hearts of the people, as big a deal as the sounding of the trumpets on trumpets. Because that's when the land came back. That's when those who were captive or indentured were freed from their indentured servanthood and their debts canceled and they had a fresh start. It was a marvelous year, the Jubilee year was. And it kept the economies of societies from going high, 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 and then dropping off into a depression, and then climb back up and drop off in a depression. It moved wealth back and forth through the community in a way that God organized it to happen. But that's a whole other story, just a very fascinating story. But this is what Christ quoted. This part of Isaiah 61, and this became essentially the theme of his ministry, his human ministry, while he was on earth. When you go and follow those through. It's also of importance to note that he ended this passage in the middle of a sentence, and he didn't read. It says he closed the book in verse 20 and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. He didn't read the last part of the sentence because the sentence was to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord and the day of the vengeance of our God. Well, Christ wasn't there to incur the vengeance or to administer the vengeance or the judgment of God on mankind, not in his first coming. Now, in his second coming, that's when he administers the judgment, but not the first coming. This was what he was there to do. He had won this battle, the spiritual battle with the devil, and then made this great announcement, the overall view of his entire ministry. Now we go to John chapter 8. We need to understand that enemy a little bit better. John chapter 8. And this is one of those engagements that Christ had with various of the Jews. It doesn't say that they were Pharisees or Sadducees in this case. They were just Jews because it starts in verse 31 where we were going to pick up this dynamic conversation taking place. And Jesus said to the Jews who believed him, these are the ones who believed him. They were friendlies. There were plenty of the Jews who were not friendlies. They weren't friendly to Christ at all. These apparently were. Or were they? Let me, you judge as we go through a few verses. He said to them, if you abide in my word, it's in verse 31, if you abide in my word or live in my word, you are my disciples indeed. And you shall know the truth. And the truth shall make you free. And that's where that statement comes from. You shall know the truth, and truth will make you free. And they said to him, we're Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free? Do you know they had a history of revisionists back then too? They just said that they had never been in bondage. They were Abraham's seed. Oh. Abraham's seed. You never were in Egypt for like 300 years as slaves? That's bondage, isn't it? Oh, what about the time when, Nebuchadnezzar came over and wailed the tar out of all of you and hauled you off to Babylon and you were slaves over there? See, they revised their history. Christ was right, and they were just empty heads when it comes to remembering things. And Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave to sin." Now, you have another kind of bondage you haven't even thought of. And it's a bondage that's just as true for us as it is for them, especially us who know what sin is and what righteousness is. If we live in sin, we are slaves to sin. And a slave is not abide in the house forever, but a son abides in the house. Therefore, the Son makes you free. You shall be free indeed. I know that you're Abraham's descendants, but you seek to kill me. Now, often Christ, he could read their minds and read their hearts. These were the guys who believed him, and some of them anyway, at least, and now they wanted to kill him. They were kind of a volatile bunch in those days. "Because my word has no place in you. I speak what I have seen with my father, and you do what you have seen with your father." And they answered and said to him, "Abraham is our father." They were incensed, going back to that. He said, "If you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham." You would act like Abraham if you were his children, but you seek to kill me. "A man who has told you the truth, which I heard from God. Abraham did not do this. You do the deeds of your father." And they said to him, "We're not born of fornication. We have one father, God." So you see, they're realizing, we can't have claim Abraham. We have to go up higher and claim God as our father. And Christ had them then where he wanted them, because this was going to be a very powerful teaching point. He said to them, "If God were your father, you would love me, for I proceeded forth and came from God. Nor have I come of myself, but he sent me." I didn't just come down here. "He sent me. Why do you not understand my speech? Because you are not able to listen to my word." That's why. "You are of your father, the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning, and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it." Christ knew the enemy. This is who he battled, and he knew him well. "But because I tell you the truth, you don't believe me. Which of you convicts me of sin? And if I tell the truth, why do you not believe me? He who is of God hears God's words. Therefore, you do not hear because you're not of God." So Christ here identifies the kind of battles that he was fighting, the enemy that he was fighting, the devil himself. And then just over a few pages, we note chapter 12, verses 27. We begin reading chapter 12, verse 27. "My soul is troubled," Christ said. You know, he's thinking about what he has to go through, the pain and the agony and the suffering of it, and the end of a life of a healthy young man, and normally would have a great future humanly ahead of him. He said, "My soul is troubled. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for your purpose, I came to this hour. So, Father, glorify your name." And a voice came down from heaven saying, "I have both glorified it and will glorify it again." Therefore, the people who stood by heard it and said that it thundered. And others said, "An angel has spoken to him." And Jesus answered and said, "This voice did not come because of me, but for your sake. Now is the judgment of this world, and the ruler of this world will be cast out. And so, and if I am lifted up, I will draw all peoples to myself." The holy seed would be on many waters, draw all peoples to himself. So Satan is the ruler of this world, you know, right now. Christ will soon be. Now let's go back, because there are other battles that we could look at. As I began to prepare the sermon, I realized, well, we can't do an exhaustive conflict dynamic here. There are too many to cover in a sermon, but there are others you can read about. But there is one important one. It's introduced in retrospect in Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10, verse 1 through 3, we'll get the setting. Luke chapter 10. Now, Christ has already sent out the apostles. He chose his apostles, the 12, sent them out on a trial run where he taught them. Then he sent them out to practice with what they learned, heal the sick, preach the gospel, cast out the demons. And after these things, in verse 1 of chapter 10, the Lord appointed 70 others also. So we have the 12 apostles, and then we have the 70. Why the 70? I'm not sure. That's the number in the Sanhedrin. I believe that's what Sanhedrin actually means, is 70. Now, Sanhedrin was the governing council of the Jews. But he appointed his own Sanhedrin in that sense and sent them two by two before his face to every city and place where he himself was about to go. And he said to them, the harvest is truly great, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray the Lord of the harvest to send his laborers into his harvest. Go your way, and here's what I want you to do, which included healing, preaching the gospel, and casting out the demons. And then in verse 17, they come back. And they're pretty excited, the 70 are. They returned with joy, because they knew what the apostles had already done, and that they had healed people, and they were able to cast out demons. And now the 70 found that Christ had given them the authority to do the same thing. And that's what they thought was the most exciting part of the whole thing, that, Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. That was their favorite thing to do, was to cast out demons, it seems like. But it's, just imagine Christ standing there, and they're all coming back, and they're all chattering and all excited, and he's listening quietly, and then somebody comes up and summarizes that, you know, even the demons were subject to us in your name. And he looks up and he says, no wonder, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. Well, the demons were just the lackeys. Satan is the big one. When did that happen? Let's go back to Isaiah again, and this time chapter 14. When did Christ see Satan fall like lightning from heaven? That must have been a phenomenal battle. And it was. Chapter 14 of Isaiah. We drop down at about verse 3 begins the section, and it speaks about a diatribe against the king of Babylon and refers to him. You will take up in verse looks like verse 4 or 5. Verse 4, you will take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say, how the oppressor has ceased, the golden city ceased. So this is about a king of Babylon. Now, Isaiah lived before the king of Babylon came to Jerusalem and took the Jews captive. So it's a prophecy. But we find that this is more than a prophecy about a king of Babylon. It was about a king of Babylon. We don't know which one specifically. And then maybe Nebuchadnezzar, maybe one other one. They had plenty of kings to choose from. But we know that the Babylon king was a type of somebody greater. And that the prophecy is actually about him. That is Lucifer. How the oppressor has ceased. The golden city ceased. Now, the oppressor has ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked. He who struck the people in wrath with a continual stroke. And when you see rulers who treat their people beating them and beating them and beating them, they have no love for the people or care for them in any way. That's the spirit of Satan. He who ruled the nations in anger. Another description of Satan. Humans too, but the ultimate description is Satan. And it goes on a little further down, we drop. Hell beneath, meaning the grave beneath, is excited about you to meet you at your coming, and it stirs up the dead for you. You know, they're going to, you know, when you die and you come down here, the grave is excited. So animating the grave here in that sense. In verse 11, your pomp is brought down to Sheol, another term for the grave, and the sound of your stringed instruments. What about the stringed instruments? Well, when you read the parallel account in Ezekiel 28, you find out there were string instruments involved. Satan was a musician, as an angel. And then we get to verse 12, the fall of Lucifer. Now, I'm going to point out here at this point, ironically, many even of conservative Christians do not believe that this is a prophecy about the devil. They think it is only a prophecy about a king of Babylon, and the parallel account in Ezekiel 28 is only about some king of Tyre, because that's what it's addressed to. It is within that, the diatribe against the human king, that the human king is a type of the devil, and so it's actually a diatribe or a prophecy against the devil. How you are fallen from heaven. Verse 12, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. You know, king of Babylon could weaken all the nations, but the devil could. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. The stars of God is a symbol for the angels. I will exalt my throne above all the angels. I will sit on the mount of the congregation in the farther sides of the north. That's the location, the spiritual address of God's throne. He wants God's throne. That's what he wants. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. It's I. Complete egocentric thinking. Yet you will be dropped down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit, God says through Isaiah. So here is the prophecy. Satan attacked the throne and Christ struck him down. He saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven because he struck him down. And that's why he fell. So that was the first major battle. When Satan chose his way and the confrontation came, this was the confrontation of the devil and the Messiah. And then there were the other battles in the Garden of Eden and then during the time of the fasting. The final thing we want to look at in just two passages are the proxy battles, where somebody fights the devil on behalf of Christ. And guess who is elected for that? Let's go to Romans chapter 16. This is a passage we don't always read about, but one we need to read about. It talks a lot about the health of God's church and what causes ill health in the church. Now I urge you, brethren, in verse 17, we're going to go through verse 20, I think. I urge you, brethren, note those who have cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine you have learned. Now, we have learned God's true doctrines, so note those that try to teach other doctrines and avoid them. For those are such who do not serve our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly, by smooth words and flattering speech, deceive the hearts of the simple. See, these are those typically what happens, and this is the history, this is our experience over many decades in the church in the modern era, is those who come up with their own doctrinal ideas and try to get a following are just doing that. They're trying to build a following. You know, they aren't willing to go out and preach their ideas to the world. They just want to, capture an audience of fine people, and then they want to get them to be their followers. Well, don't be deceived. And don't be simple. Simple means You're open to influence. You haven't locked on to the trajectory of truth. You're open to influence. You can sort of go this or that way or that way. Eve was simple in the Garden of Eden. She hadn't locked on to the truth yet. For your obedience has become known to all. Therefore, I am glad on your behalf. The Roman brethren were a solid group. But I want you to be wise in what is good and simple, or in this case carries more of a sense of ignorant concerning evil. Simple concerning evil. Evil is no sway over you, but be wise in what is good. And the God of peace, notice how this ends, God of peace will crush Satan under your feet shortly. The God of peace will do that, crush Satan under your feet shortly. So we fight a battle when you run up against those with false doctrines, trying to, you know, divide the church. That's a spiritual battle that we fight with faithfulness and with wisdom on behalf of Christ, or rather, he fights through us. We're his proxy in that sense. Let's look at one more. This is in 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5. And you need to study lions. I have a whole sermon I give on this one sometimes, so I'll help you study lions. Lions are really quite amazing. Just don't ever become lunch for a lion. Or even a tiger or a leopard. I just read a story in a sports magazine. I have the book, so it's in a book. But this was an excerpt from a book by a man named Jim Corbett of hunting the Panwar leopard, man-eater. He had killed, I forget how many, 30 or 40 people. Documented in a certain area. And the only way they could get him is they had baited him with a goat. He ate the goat. They knew what patch of woods he was in. But there was only one tree to climb, and it was a tree that grew out of a steep slope out at an angle like this, which is easy to walk up because the hunter actually walked up to the branch where he sat down. And then they put thorns on behind him, which the leopard tried to pull out during the night. And then he dropped his torch, flashlight, and so finally, he had to wait until he could see the white of the throat before he fired his gun. But he did get the leopard. But he was terribly frightened. You know, when you're up against a man-eater, that's significant stuff. Therefore, thinking about that, turn to verse 8 of chapter 5. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. He only roars while he's hunting. When he gets on the sneak attack, he goes silent. When he's out hunting, then he roars to see where the game is or to signal to the rest of the lions. They hunt in a group. But resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. But may the God of grace, who called us to his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after you have suffered a while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you. So again, we fight against the influence of the devil in our own lives and within the body of Christ, and do that on behalf of Christ, Christ backing us up, the power that works through us. And we are the proxies in that sense. And there's one final proxy, and this gives us hope as we anticipate the time when the world is freed from Satan and we are freed from having to battle him in Revelation chapter 12. This is the beginning of his end. And there's a brief release later, but this is the beginning of his end. It's in Revelation 12, verse 7. We don't know exactly when this battle will take place. We know that Christ does not fight Satan directly this time. And this time the proxy is not human, it's angelic. And we even know his name. It's the Archangel Michael. But this happens prior to Christ's return, it appears. The war broke out in heaven. This is verse 7 of chapter 12 of Revelation. War broke out in heaven, and Michael and his angels fought, and the dragon fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old, the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So there comes a time when there is a second battle between the forces of Christ, being the angels with Michael, and the devil and his demonic angels. that takes place. And then, of course, ultimately that ends in Revelation 20 when Satan is bound with the Day of Atonement pictures. He's released for a short time at the end of the 1,000 years, but then the binding is forever after that. And the battles will be over. In the meantime, though, we have battles like Christ had battles with the evil one. Let us be triumphant through the power of Christ and the Father.